Hi, I'm Gordon Lamphere with the Real Finds podcast, where we have real conversations with key entrepreneurs, activists, and researchers who are shaping the real estate industry and, as a result, our world. On today's podcast, we'll be speaking with Justin Den Herter. Justin is a professor at the Cooper Union for the Advancement of Science and Art and a principal at T.Y. Lin, a global engineering leader. On the podcast, we take a deep dive into mass timber, its commercial real estate applications, and growing economic viability for larger projects. If you're a developer, investor, or looking for an alternative to traditional construction, today's episode is a must listen.
Justin, thank you so much for hopping on the podcast today.
Thank you so much for the invitation, Gordon. I'm glad to spend time with you.
So one of the things I wanted to start off talking about is what got you into the world of timber and real estate?
Yeah, so I work as a structural engineer, and I've worked on many different forms of buildings with all manner of different construction, common construction material. And some of those old buildings were constructed of heavy timber. So, for example, a heavy timber and masonry building that we converted into, a commercial real estate venture where we added stories on top. We cut openings in walls, modified the floor plate. And I was really enamored with that experience, which differed from my experience building designing new buildings. And over time, I began to understand and learn about this emerging technology of mass timber, which to some degree has been around for quite some time. It's gaining more traction as new elements of mass timber come to market. So I began, just out of curiosity, partly out of a sense of purpose, and it was quite intentional, because the manner in which we've been designing and constructing buildings and the materials that we use actually contribute pretty significantly in terms of energy production and what we call embodied carbon, which contributes to climate change quite substantially. Data will tell you that 40% of human generated carbon emissions come from the built environment. Mass timber plays a key role in that, that I'm sure we can touch upon. But in summary, it is a low energy, low carbon building material that is also a renewable resource. We can grow more trees. We can't easily at the moment grow more iron ore.
So, I mean, I grew up in my grandfather's wood shop, and I've seen a lot of wood in my day. I'm also a fourth generation developer and broker, and I rarely see significant amounts of wood on your average construction site. So I'm curious, like, what makes mass timber structurally competitive when we're talking about building multi-story buildings?
Yeah, I'm sure you have fond memories of being in the workshop, the smell and the feel of that place. And I think that is part of the appeal of mass timber buildings, the look, the smell, and there are many studies of the benefits to human mental and physical health of being in a space like that. In terms of the benefit of timber as a building structural material, it is partly that, the experiential qualities, the health benefits, but timber has been a construction material. It's one of the oldest construction materials that humans have used. There is a bit of a misnomer that timber can't be durable, but in fact, some of the oldest human-made structures in the world are timber structures have been standing for hundreds, even thousands of years, especially in Asia, even in high seismic zones. And part of the benefit of that why wood is so durable is because of its lightness, relative lightness in terms of its density and its lower mass compared to other comparable building materials, and its strength to weight ratio as a function of its light weight. So timber beams do a pretty good job of spanning and supporting loads and functioning as a beam or floor system. Obviously, you see some pretty monumental trees in nature, so it also can function really well under axial loads and in column scenarios. The difference between the evolution, I would say, of timber construction is that we can now combine small components of wood, 2x4s, 1x3s, 2x3s. We can glue them together with high strength epoxies. We can press them in a hydraulic press. And the end result is something that is stronger than all the individual components. This allows for longer spans and column-free spaces and taller buildings made out of timber than we've ever been built, ever been able to build. Now, this is important because the predecessor to mass timber was essentially heavy timber, which is just large format wood components that were cut from large, very old growth trees. Now we now understand how important it is to save those large growth trees. It's important for many different reasons. So as a result, the fact that we can build larger buildings, span farther, hold more load, create really unique spaces with this small format wood in this technology is what's spurring the kind of mass timber revolution.
And I think much of the revolution has been spurred, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, by the move towards looking at it as a more sustainable resource. How has that played out, and what really are the sustainability benefits of using mass timber?
Yeah, that is an excellent question. I think you're right to say that it's a catalyst for the expansion of mass timber. It's a really important, and it's happening at a pretty pivotal moment. It is a sustainable material relative to structural steel or cast-in-place concrete. And the reason is this term that we use called embodied carbon, which is a reflection of the embodied energy that it takes and the amount of carbon emitted to extract the material, fabricate the material, transport the material, install it, etc. So the whole building life cycle, that sum total of energy and carbon is what we call the embodied carbon of a building structure or of any material. Structural steel and concrete take an enormous amount of energy because to produce, and as a result, an enormous amount of carbon. That's largely because it's an intensive extraction process, right? You're taking these materials from the earth in a high energy intensive way, but then you need to melt it down at extremely high temperatures, which takes a lot of energy. Juxtapose that over against mass timber, which does take energy, right? To harvest wood from a forest, to bring it to a fabrication plant, and to create a piece of mass timber, you need to typically kiln dry the wood. The difference is that it can be dried at much lower temperatures than it would require to, say, melt, you know, iron ore to become part of steel or to create cement. Those are very energy intensive. And the last component, which I already touched on a little bit, is that we can easily regrow trees within our lifetime. So if we design a mass timber building, we calculate that volume of wood within that building, we can equate that to a number of trees, plants, in theory, that same number of trees. And within 80 years or so, we can have regrown the material that went into that building. And that's really why this is so important, to be thinking about the reciprocity between what we're building as humans and what exists in nature, to set ourselves up for multi-generational success and multi-generational resources.
Yeah, and my wife grew up in timber country. I think that there's a lot of people out there that don't understand the way in which timber can grow and be harvested as a viable economic resource, and actually as a form of decarbonization. I'm curious, when we come down to things, ultimately, decarbonization is great, but the primary driver of most economic activity is economics. So,
right.
So what are the economics and the investor demand for mass timber, particularly on the construction of larger buildings?
So I want to preface this by acknowledging that I'm a structural engineer. So while I'm reviewing cost estimates and helping to make the case for mass timber, there are many folks involved in that, from foresters to mass timber producers, to construction workers, to insurance folks. All of these play a key role in establishing how much it costs to create a mass timber building. But what I will say is, my experience here is, it's important to acknowledge that we are in North America at the threshold of building more mass timber buildings. As a result, there are things that we need to raise awareness about. There are things that we need to learn, and we need the experience collectively to get to essentially use a weightlifting analogy. We need to get more reps so that we better understand the material and understand how to design and construct with it. So I've had many projects with sustainability desires express interest in mass timber, and mass timber has kind of fallen by the wayside as a viable option because of economics early on in the project or in the process, which is unfortunate, but it is the reality that there is still lack of familiarity with different components of mass timber buildings. There are restrictions within building codes, for example. So there's a lot that we need to learn. Personally, I don't feel that there is a cost premium for the material. I think over time, as we get more experience, we will see that it will become more and more economically viable, and therefore mass timber will be pushed to the fore, in potentially just a few years' time. Things move quickly here in the United States. As we gain more experience and as things become more economically viable, I think the cost premium is predominantly due to the lack of familiarity and limited options. As more mass timber suppliers and fabricators come onto the scene, as building codes understand that this is truly a viable material for buildings from 0 to 18 stories tall and potentially even taller than that, we'll see it proliferate more. And I think the market will work out the cost premium, quote unquote, components of that.
So I know you mentioned unfamiliarity as a driver. Can you dive into that a little bit more?
Yeah, I can. When we say unfamiliar, when I use the term unfamiliarity, that does sound contradictory to a statement I made earlier that we've been designing with timber for hundreds, if not thousands of years as humans. The difference is in the material itself, in its makeup. So unfamiliarity in this case has to do with code restrictions or code limitations, making sure that the building is safe from a fire protection standpoint, from a moisture protection standpoint. Because there are epoxies in most mass timber components, not all, but in many of them, it adds the added complication that you need to very closely monitor moisture content within these elements from the moment of fabrication through the point of enclosure of the building, right? And if that moisture content isn't monitored and staying within a certain range, it can create issues. It can create issues like mold or staining. In extreme examples, it can have an effect on the material properties and the strength and stiffness properties of the wood. But that said, wood is quite adaptable to moisture if it's properly maintained through the process of fabrication to construction. It can quickly dry out and be one of the most durable materials on the planet. From a fire protection standpoint, we shouldn't shy away from it. Wood is a combustible material. We should embrace that fact and understand how we deal with that. So what is great about wood is that there's a lot of testing, there's a lot of data about how wood performs in a fire event. And it actually behaves in an extremely predictable manner. So if we know that by code, if we have a building of a certain type, a commercial building, and we know that that has to have a 1 hour rating, 1 hour fire rating, that means if there's a fire event of a certain magnitude, the building needs to stay standing and stay stable for 1 hour to give folks enough time to get out of the building safely. If we know the species of the wood, we can, with tried and tested equations, understand how much larger we need to make that member in terms of wood volume to achieve that 1 hour rating. And what is so remarkable about wood is that it has its own fire protection mechanism embedded within it, which is the effect of charring. And if you've ever thrown a log on a campfire in your fireplace, you see this blackened blanket that essentially props up when the wood's exposed to fire. Well, that char functions as a protective blanket to preserve the inner portion of the wood. That's why you have to poke at the fire to remove and scrape free from some of the char so that the fire can perpetuate. So there is lots of science and codified ways for us to plan for that, to make sure that the building can be safe. So I'd say moisture and fire protection are two key elements that absolutely need to be focused on. And you need experts on all stages, structural engineers, architects, fabricators, and construction workers all need to understand that process and collaborate on how you're going to handle that for a given project.
So you mentioned also earlier the regulatory code, and I'd love to follow back on that and understand beyond fire protection, where are the problems that are occurring in the regulatory code, and are there places in the country that are more open to the use of mass timber than others, and kind of how is that playing out?
Yeah, I'll just preface this by saying Europe is ahead of us in this. They've been designing mass timber buildings for longer. There are many great precedents and projects built in Europe they're probably a decade ahead of us in that regard. Within the United States, you know, it's interesting if you look at a map. You mentioned your wife's from timber country. If you follow the trees, if you look at a map of forests in the United States, that will tell you a story about where mass timber buildings are more likely to be found. So Pacific Northwest has many amazing forests, many of them Douglas fir and soft woods that are ideal for putting in mass timber components. So naturally, you know, British Columbia, Washington State, Oregon, and the Pacific Northwest are leading the way in terms of design and construction of mass timber buildings. We're seeing more and more in Michigan and Wisconsin. Milwaukee has the tallest mass timber building in the world, if not North America. And we're seeing it expand more and more to the Northeast. So there is a direct correlation to where the forests are, right? And this makes sense because there's economic incentive and opportunity to take wood right from the forest next door and put it in buildings. Now, how that correlates with building codes, at a very high level, codes in the Pacific Northwest have been on the forefront of embracing mass timber and accelerating what is possible in mass timber as sort of somewhat of an incubator, or they're paving the way. They're showing the rest of the country the way. In a place like New York City, where I am based, you know, it is quite a unique scenario. It's a very dense urban environment. We have different challenges with respect to adaptation of mass timber buildings as a result of that. So many jurisdictions, New York City included, in the northeast portion of the country, have been slower to adopt mass timber, but the adoption is happening. Most city building codes are founded on the International Building Code, the IBC. The latest version of IBC allows up mass timber buildings up to 18 stories by code. A project like the Ascent in Milwaukee, the tallest mass timber building, those take a prescriptive approach. So there, the local building department and building officials say, if you show us the data, if you show us the analysis and prove it out, we will approve it on the basis of empirical testing, rigorous structural analysis, and we'll allow you to go above and beyond the code because we want to be early adopters of this new technology. So it is quite a range, but there is a direct correlation to where forests are and where timber fabricators are.
So let's talk about where some of the properties that have been successful and examples of successfully deployed mass timber are. I'm curious, what do you think some of the best case studies are of successful projects, both from, you know, a structural view and kind of an economic view as well?
Yeah, since we're here in the context of commercial real estate, I would say that Hines has created some really beautiful mass timber buildings, and they were pioneering in that sense. Their T3 building in Minneapolis was a very early adapter of mass timber technology in a commercial setting. So that's a very important precedent. In the Pacific Northwest, there's a project called Brock Commons, a residential hall. And that was the first mass timber project in North America to really push the limits from a height standpoint, 18 stories tall. I don't recall exactly when that was built. I want to say 2017, 2018, something like that. So those are two examples. We've touched on Ascent in Milwaukee. Again, pushing the boundaries of height. I'm curious and interested and passionate about bringing these opportunities to the Northeast, which is primarily where I'm practicing. And I've been working on a really intriguing project with the architect Herzog Demeron and Sasaki at Amherst College. There's a great example of a mass timber project in the Northeast, at UMass Amherst, the Olver building that was completed in around 2018. That was the first new mass timber building that I was exposed to and really intrigued by in our backyard, so to speak. Beautiful projects. Lears Weinzappel was the architect for it. And years later, we got the fortunate opportunity with Herzog, Demeron, and Sasaki to design a mass timber building for Amherst College, right down the road from UMass Amherst. And we were going to design a new construction mass timber student center and dining hall for that for Amherst College as part of their newly rolled out sustainability campus master plan. Given our experience with adaptive reuse projects and reusing existing buildings, we actually guided the team during concept design. We said, yeah, we've worked out 70 different beautiful concepts of mass timber buildings with Herzog Demeron, all of which would be world-class buildings. But then, even though it was mass timber, it's still not as sustainable as trying to reuse the existing building that was already on the site that was proposed for this new student center. So we guided the team and said, based on our experience of adding stories to existing buildings, we think we can take this new mass timber building and actually put it on top of the existing one that's there. You'll increase your square footage. You'll lower your embodied carbon by saving what's there. You'll save some new materials. And to our surprise, we weren't kicked out of the room. The idea was embraced because there's a lot of challenges with doing that. So we don't make that suggestion lightly. It was only because of our experience that we felt confident to do so. And we moved forward. So we moved forward with this approach. The existing building on that site was a massive cast in place concrete structure. Some of those elements were post-tension concrete, some conventionally reinforced concrete. It was built in 1967, I believe, an old science lab building. And we said, this structure must have some additional capacity. How can we evaluate quickly the existing structure, determine what its propensity might be, what its capability might be to support additional stories in mass timber? And that's what we went with. And why mass timber in that scenario? Because it's lighter. So we could potentially add another story or span farther with the vertical extension and minimize the amount of reinforcement and the amount of cost and complexity that comes with that reinforcement of the existing structure below. So I talked about some mass timber new construction precedents. Personally, I'm really excited about mass timber's ability to enhance existing building material, to facilitate adaptive reuse. Imagine old industrial buildings converted into commercial real estate, enhanced by the ability to add or insert mass timber within or on top of or alongside of those existing buildings to create a really unique space that respects the history of that building's life cycle and its different uses over time. So that Amherst College Student Center project has now topped out. They're enclosing the building. We're really excited for it to be open and hopefully be part of a paradigm shift of how mass timber can be beneficial, not just in new construction as part of decarbonization, but let's go a step further than that and think about how it can help us revitalize existing building stock.
So beyond revitalizing existing building stock and adaptive reuse, what do you see as the broader implications for applying mass timber in the commercial setting?
Well, if you think about commercial real estate in the form of, say, office space, for example. You know, there are many studies about not just the mental and physical health benefits of being in a biophilic space with natural textures expressed and exposed, but if you think about it from an office standpoint of the benefits of mental health to your employees and what that means for creativity and productivity in the workplace, this is a measurable thing, and there are studies out there that that prove the benefits of creativity, employee retention, in and around having mass timber within that space. If you extend that to, say, educational facilities, preschools, elementary schools, whatever the case might be, people want to be in a beautiful, calming interior. And the fact that mass timber, provides that benefit also means that you don't have to hang a ceiling. You don't have to clad the walls and the columns. You leave the structure exposed. So if you think about tenant fit outs and all the costs that comes with taking down partition walls, putting them in the landfill, building new drywall partitions, replacing floor and ceiling finishes every time a tenant moves in and out, I think there could be really beneficial long-term benefits to having the timber be expressed and exposed within the space. So that's probably just the tip of the iceberg, Gordon, but those are some of the immediate benefits that come to mind.
Beyond some of the benefits we discussed and some of the issues we discussed, what do you think your average developer or your average investor gets the most wrong about mass timber?
I still think, for my part, from the design side, I think we need to raise awareness. We need to work with our clients to educate them, to debunk myths and misconceptions. I touched on the fire component and fire safety. I still think there is a common misconception from developers, from insurance providers, and people who are assessing risk, that because it's wood, that you're building a tinderbox, and mass timber, by virtue of its massiveness, behaves very differently in a fire scenario than, say, stick-built, balloon-framed wood construction, which will go up in flames like a tinderbox. That's why we have to encase it in drywall and protect it. So I still think that fire protection is one thing that we need to continue to educate and raise awareness around. And I also think cost premium is part of that too. And I recognize that there are cost premiums where we are right now. And I think that is, again, just our collective lack of experience, our lack of built examples. And here is where, for a second, I can just touch on, in my mind, this is the importance of public projects and public architecture. Because in most jurisdictions, it is very challenging to build a building for a public agency on time and on budget. The process can be very bureaucratic and challenging. And I think that's a fact in many places. But here in New York City, I have the privilege of having completed design on 3 mass timber projects that we hope will go into construction within the upcoming year. And I just think having public architecture where people, all people, can go experience, smell, touch, and see just how beautiful these buildings are, I think that will be a catalyst for the private sector. If the public sector can do it, certainly the private sector can do it. Because I'm telling public sector, the private sector is doing all of this. We're getting projects built on time, on budget. Like, you need to consider the ways in which the private sector is operating efficiently to get things done. But then on the, you know, vice versa, if we have a few public projects that are really sticking their neck out there to embrace this new technology on works of civic architecture, I think that can be part of the benefit that the public sector can bring to the private sector. And I really hope that becomes part of the catalyst for the private sector to be more open-minded about adopting mass timber.
So we've had a great conversation thus far. And one of the things that we always like to do to wrap up our conversations is go into our final four. One of my favorite questions I'd love to ask is, where do you see commercial real estate and commercial architecture going 10 years from now?
So there is where it will go, and I hope it is where I hope it will go. Those might be two slightly different things, but I hope they're aligned. So I'll talk about it from what I hope, in hopes that I'll help conjure up this future. I think I hope that we will see more mass timber buildings as a result of people seeing the economic, aligning the economic opportunities with this beautiful, very exciting material, and that we will see the market side value catch up to that, to help us more easily make the case that more commercial real estate should be mass timber. And I think the other aspect of that, so that can be the push from the private sector component, that mass timber is in every conversation as a viable construction building material for almost every project. From the public side, I would love to see, and I don't mean this in any sort of a punitive way, I think we need to understand the data of how much energy and how much carbon goes into our buildings, so that we can make more informed decisions as individuals, as design teams, as real estate developers, as city agencies. At every level, we need to have the data so we can understand how we're doing. And we've done a remarkable job on this in the past decade on operational carbon. Our buildings have become extremely energy efficient, and regulations have caught up to that and are holding folks accountable to really high energy efficiency standards. We need to mirror that, but now the focus needs to be on the embodied energy and the embodied carbon within our building materials. So I think we will see within the next decade a similar kind of tracking mechanisms and policy, but also market opportunity around understanding a building's portfolio and the embodied carbon and the embodied energy within that. And that will help us lead to more opportunity, I hope.
So one of the ways that we like to find more opportunity is improving ourselves. And there's a lot of younger listeners to our podcast. And I'm curious, Justin, if you had to look back at yourself, say in your early 20s, and give yourself one bit of advice, what would it be?
I love this question. I try and embed some level of reflection at different timescales. Daily, what was the best thing I did today? What did I despise that I had to do today? I think about that weekly for, you know, I try and make this a habit. And I, of course, I think about it annually. So you offering that question now over the context of a decade, almost two decades now that I've been an engineer, I'm not as young as I once was, is a really wonderful question. For me, I have two answers, or two parts of an answer to that. First would be to consider the why, not just the how. And I found in my engineering education and early on in my career, it was about becoming technically excellent, knowing my stuff inside and out for all building materials, for every type of building design, and that came across my desk. And that's the right thing to do early on in the career, in one's career. And it was the right thing for me to do too. But I never thought about the why in terms of what are the buildings that I'm part of creating? Who are they serving? What are they for? And to what end? Should I be working on this? Is this just because we can create an incredible analysis model or rendering of a project does not necessarily mean that it should be built or be built that way, right? We need to think about the implications on the natural environment, on the local community and the place where we're building that building, making sure the building's in the right context, that it is for the community to the degree that it can be, but also that it is where the material's sourced from and how is it affecting the folks in that place. So thinking about the why in the build in my career is a big part of where I am now that I wish I was thinking about a little bit earlier in my career. And then the second component of that, Gordon, sorry for the long answer to this, but I am
totally fine. About this, yeah.
Is to embrace, in my context, embrace my non-engineering passions. And if you have young commercial real estate developers out there, think about the things that make you unique, your passions, your hobbies. They are not separate from you as a developer. And I say over the course of my own career, I love reading and writing and poetry. I love trees. And to begin to think about how structural engineering and poetry and trees are interrelated rather than separate compartmented aspects of who I am has actually been a catalyst for my career because it's helped me focus my energies. This is what I want to do. I want to work on mass timber buildings that support healthy forests and do it in a way that is poetic, creating elegant, efficient, equitable buildings that have a wonderful reciprocity with the natural environment. So, you know, I jokingly with my team here use the term uniqueness, but I replace the U with Y-O-U. So what is your uniqueness? What is it that makes you distinctly you? And how can you infuse that into what you do for your occupation? So I wish I had thought about that 18 years ago.
Well, I think that's lovely. I'll say definitively around here, we've really worked hard to, and I economic empowerment and community revitalization is so near and dear to my heart. And we always try to find our why, which is to make our community better. And I think if you don't focus on that and you're only focusing on your own economic bottom line, this can be a very bleak industry. So I couldn't agree more. One of the ways that we like to try to find maybe not necessarily deeper meaning, but a deeper wisdom at the very least is through books. And I'm curious if there's a book that we should be picking up anytime soon.
I'm going to answer this in a quick three parts. One, from a forest related standpoint, there are two books who've had two of many books that have had a profound impact on me. Most recently, I would say there's a book called Designing the Forest and Other Mass Timber Futures by Lindsay Wickstrom, her architecture firm Mataforma does a lot of beautiful work in and around mass timber as a system. So that changed my perspective because it helped me think holistically about the forest and the mass timber building as not separate entities, but interconnected entities. And then that was reinforced even further by a book called How to Love a Forest by Ethan Tapper, who's a forester in Vermont. That is, I think, just a very beautifully written book, but it doesn't pull punches about how we need to roll up our sleeves and engage in forest management, and how that can be beneficial for a built environment of wood. So that's my forestry-related component. Then the pure structural engineering part of me, Peter Rice is one of the most well-known structural engineers of modern history, and his autobiography, An Engineer Imagines, is just really beautiful. And then the last component would be the poetry side. And I love the poet W.S. Merwin for who he was as a person, which was a steward of a palm forest in Hawaii that he grew single-handedly with, or not single-handedly, but together with his wife. And he, and of course, that had a profound impact on his poetry. And I say that because for me, poetry is a way of being attentive to the world and paying deep attention to considering the materials that we're using. In poetry, the materials are our language and our words. And when you write a poem, if you write it successfully, and there are many different forms of poetry out there, but a good poem, every word is placed there with intentionality. And that's how I want to consider beams and columns in my buildings. They're there for a purpose. They're designed efficiently and elegantly, safely, of course, but that every component is put there with thought and care and with intentionality and with collaboration. So the poetry of W.S. Merwin has really had a big impact on me too.
Wow. Those are all great examples of books we should pick up. But collaboration is the whole point of the podcast. I started this primarily as a way to just learn more about the industry, and it's grown into a wonderful community. So who should be the next member of the community that pops on the podcast?
I'm going to answer this question from the mass timber component in hopes that I've sparked some interest and intrigue around mass timber. I'll give three names. Michael Green, who has his own architecture firm, Michael Green Architecture, or Michael Green Architects, has been and is a pioneer on mass timber within buildings. He has a few TED Talks on the topic, and I've got to know Michael pretty well over the last couple of years. He would be an amazing person to interview. Within Midwest, because I understand that's your neck of the woods, Gordon, Sandra Lupien from Michigan State University has done incredible work trying to create a mass timber ecosystem on behalf of the state of Michigan and Michigan State University. And then within the Pacific Northwest, Erica Spiritos, she's a mass timber expert who has her own consultancy, and she advises projects on mass timber. And she's just very eloquent. In speaking about it. So I think those would be three great folks to talk about if you and your listeners would be intrigued to hear more about mass timber.
So we'll have to reach out, but if somebody wants to reach out to you, what's the best way to get in contact?
I'd say reach out. I'm not on social media save for LinkedIn.
That sounds very mentally healthy. Media.
You can reach out to me on LinkedIn, Justin Denherter, or you can feel free to email me at justin.denherter at tylin www.thefinesmith.com. I'd love to continue the conversation with some of your listeners, tell you more about what we're up to here, and hopefully have opportunities to collaborate and share further.
Justin, thank you so much for hopping on the podcast, and we hope to have you on in the future.
Thank you, Gordon. Really appreciate it.
Thanks again to Justin. We appreciate his insights. And if you enjoy the podcast, please give us a like, a 5-star rating, and a review. Your comments, interactions, and subscriptions truly matter and help us continue to get quality guests. You can find us on YouTube, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gordon Lamphere with the Real Finds Podcast, and thank you for listening.